fortunate to have so many visitors, and I want to add my welcome to you. If you did not fill out a card, we'd like for you to do that and leave it on the table after the service, because we like to know who we have had the privilege of being with on this Lord's Day. The first family I met that I thought were visitors was David Martin and his wife. David was born on the island. His father was one of the ministers here, and his father, Bruce Martin, and I served together for a long time. And David now has a family with two children, and he's with us this morning. And I've met several others that have been with us on other occasions, and it's always a delight to have repeat visitors. But we're very happy for you to be here. Labor Day weekend is one of my favorite times. I guess it was because when I was a child, it marked the beginning of school the following week. And by the time September rolled around, I was tired of summer and I was ready to go back to school. I don't know if children who start in August still feel that way as we did in the earlier years. Mainly, I have a great appreciation for men and women who work hard and who work to excel and who are very accomplished in whatever they have chosen to do. I guess I could consider myself as a worker, although I sometimes have the image of the worker being the person who is out after a storm trying to get the power lines back up and facing all the hazards and the difficulties which that entails, or the man who is out in the middle of winter when it's snowing and cold and he's having to fix some power line or dig some ditch. Those are the real workers. The first church I served as minister after college was in a union town. I grew up in Texas where unions were almost a bad word. In fact, I had uncles who, you talk about a union of workers, and they thought it was a communist plot. So here I am 21 years old, and I go to serve a church that is in a town that is highly unionized. It was a mining community. And not only were the miners organized, the clerks at the grocery store were organized. Quite a shift in anything I had experienced before. And I learned a lot in those 10 years I was there about the difficulties between labor and management. And I came to admire the men who worked so hard in going down a mile underground each day, and in a very dangerous circumstance did the mining work. To me, those were the workers. Those were the men who did, who labored. In that experience, I learned something that impressed me and affected my own life. I learned that most of those men did not like their jobs. Most of them had taken jobs at the mines after high school rather than going to college, and they were making extremely high wages. And they had benefits, and they could, after about 10 years, they could not afford to quit and go somewhere else because they would lose all those benefits and could not possibly make the kind of money they were making at the mines, but they despised their jobs. They hated every morning when they had to get on the bus that took them out to the mines. I made up my mind then, and it's what I would advise every young person. I would never stay in a job that I did not enjoy, and I wanted to do something in life that would bring me personal satisfaction and that I would look forward to every day. And of course, that caused me, when I was in my early 30s, to go back to college and to prepare myself to practice law as well as to preach. But it is a principle that I think is so important, that a man or a woman should find satisfaction in what they do for a living. In fact, we are taught this in the Old Testament. There are two places in the book of Ecclesiastes, which itself is kind of a negative book about life, but in two different places, Solomon says, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. Can do nothing better than to find satisfaction in their own toil. And then in the third chapter of Ecclesiastes, in verse 22, Solomon wrote, so I saw that there is nothing better for a person than to enjoy their work. Nothing better than to enjoy their work. Since your work is what you do for most of your life, blessed is the person who finds satisfaction and enjoyment in what one does. There are some principles that we need to remind ourselves about from time to time, about the worker and the employer. The Old Testament, of course, was a theocracy, which meant it was not only a religious government, it was a government whose laws were based on religious teaching. In two places in the book of Deuteronomy, there are some principles about the worker that I think are important. In Deuteronomy 24, verses 14 to 15, I read, do not take advantage of a hired worker who is poor and needy, whether that worker is a fellow Israelite or a foreigner residing in one of your towns. Pay them their wages each day before sunset, because they are poor and are counting on it. Otherwise, they may cry to the Lord against you, and you will be guilty of sin. It's hard to imagine someone so poor that they have to have their payment or their reward for working at the end of every day, but in that culture, that was true. And when people are so needy and need work so badly, it would be easy to manipulate them so that you did not pay them as scheduled. And the law of the Old Testament was that whether a hired worker is a fellow Israelite or a foreigner makes no distinction. You pay him his wages at the end of the day because he's counting on it. Another place that the book of Deuteronomy deals with this social contract between the worker and employer. I have this reading. If any of your people, Hebrew men or women, sell themselves to you and serve you 6 years, in the seventh year you must let them go free. And when you release them, do not send them away empty-handed. Supply them liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, and your wine press. Give to them as the Lord your God has blessed you. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. That is why I give you this command today. It was possible in that time for workers to sort of sell themselves into bondage to somebody else. And this is a law of liberation as well as work. The rule was, if somebody sold themselves, whether a Hebrew or a foreigner, to be a worker for you, that contract lasts only 6 years. And then in the seventh year, they must be allowed to go free. And as a bonus, you're not simply to let them go free empty-handed. You are to share with them what you've benefited from their labor. I guess that's the earliest precedent for the retirement fund. But that was the law that protected the workers in the Old Testament. Jesus was aware of the principles in the Old Testament regarding labor. In the Gospel of Luke, chapter 10 and verse 7, Jesus makes this statement, "The worker deserves his wages." His brother James became the leader of the church after it was started in Jerusalem, and he wrote one of the earliest writings of the New Testament. And in the fifth chapter of James, he addresses this problem of one group getting very rich on the work of others and not those workers not being adequately compensated for. He says, "Now listen, you rich people. I've always imagined there were not any rich people there in the audience. It's like sometimes preachers will get up and attack the enemy that is not even anywhere near the audience that he's speaking to." And that's kind of what James does here. "Now listen, you rich people, weep and howl because of the misery that is coming on you. Your wealth has rotted and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who was not opposing you." There's a lot of discussion, and that's good, about whether our society, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. But that has always been kind of typical. These rich people had gotten rich because they had not shared their riches with their workers, and they had accumulated the wealth only for themselves. There is a principle of the distribution of wealth which is important because it allows for everybody in a community to prosper. If only a few rich people accumulate all the wealth and they just have it for themselves and save it for themselves, that creates a hardship on the whole economy of a culture. I am reminded that God, when he made man, realized a man needed to work. I've often said a man needs to get up in the morning and feel like he has a job that he needs to go to. It's just part of our identity as men. In Genesis chapter 2, after he created Adam, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. And so from the very beginning, man was intended to be a worker because, as Ecclesiastes said, finding in satisfaction in one's own work is a blessing of life, and it gives one a sense of satisfaction about life. I mentioned the problem that James addressed was the accumulation of wealth in the hands of very few and it not being shared. That creates not only problems and unhappiness for a culture, it creates unhappiness for the individual. Ecclesiastes is an interesting book because it almost takes opposite positions about several things. And one of the things that it takes kind of contrary views with itself is on this issue of work and wealth. In the second chapter of Ecclesiastes, it says, "So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun." And then he tells you why. And this is a very interesting thing. He says, "Because I must leave them to the one who comes after me." You can't take it with you. That's one absolute truth. You can't take it with you. And so you must leave it behind, and all the work and toil that you have given to accumulate, when you die, it's somebody else's. "I must leave them to the one who comes after me, and who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. And yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun." In other words, he's saying, I have worked all these years and worked all this hard, and I have accumulated wealth, and now when I die, I've got to leave it to somebody who hasn't worked a day for it. He says, "This is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless." Now, the key phrase in the book of Ecclesiastes, if you want to have a key to interpret the book, is the phrase "under the sun." And he's essentially saying, if all you do is for what you get out of it under the sun, that is, while you're still living, then many of the things that we pour ourselves into is really meaningless. And one of the things is, if you have worked only for what you receive from your work under the sun, just keep in mind, someday you'll leave it to somebody who hasn't worked a day for it, and you don't know whether they'll have the same values that you have or what they will do with what you have worked so hard to keep. That impresses on us the need to share while we are still living and while we can enjoy the benefit of sharing. One of the most interesting statements by the Apostle Paul that he makes in one of his letters in Colossians, he says, he admonishes them, "Let him who stole steal no more, but rather let him labor with his hands." And then he adds another phrase that we must keep in mind. He doesn't say let him labor with his hands so that he can get rich. He says, "So let him labor with his hands so that he can give to those who have need." The joy of working and being prosperous is not simply that we can enjoy the fruits of it, but rather we can enjoy the matter of sharing it in such a way that others who have not been as blessed as we have can enjoy it. My father was a great believer in work, and that included not only himself, but included his children. And I don't know where he came up with this idea, but at age 13, he thought every child should work. And so when my older sister turned 13, she was told to go get a job. And she got a job at the old TG&Y stores in Oklahoma, if you remember those stores. And when I turned 13, I got a job next door to that store at C's Drugstore. And regardless of our studies and any extracurricular activities we had at school, my sister and I had to work because Daddy thought at 13, a child ought to work. Like I say, I don't know why he came up with that age as the defining time for. At times I've thought, well, you know, I had the rest of my life to work. I don't know why I had to start so early, but it didn't hurt me. One of the things I remember, and my sister remembered, when we started working at age 13, our father made us memorize Colossians chapter 3, verses 22 through 25. It is written to slaves, but we can substitute the idea of an employee in that. It says, slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything and do it, not only when their eye is on you and to win their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know what you will receive, that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. Anyone who does wrong will be repaid for his wrong, and there is no favoritism. This idea was firmly embedded in our minds as young people, that we were working not in the presence of the employer, but when the employer was nowhere around, we were still in the presence of God, and that we worked not for men, but we work for the Lord. And that's a pretty heavy thing for a 13-year-old to kind of grasp, but that was drilled into us very strongly. And it's a good principle. It means that what we do as a worker, if we think of it that we're doing it in the presence of our Lord and as a witness to how the Lord has changed and influenced our lives, we can understand that better. When I was training to become a minister at Abilene Christian College, all of us young men were anxious to get out into local work and to preach. And we had men who were of a generation before us who greatly inspired us, and all of us wanted to get out and see if we could match their results. In Dallas, it was John Bannister at the Skillman Church. In Fort Worth, it was Leroy Brownlow at the Polytechnic Church. In Lubbock, it was Norval Young at the Broadway Church. And so we were all anxious. And my favorite professor picked up on that one day in class, and he gave some advice that I have never forgotten. He said, boys, remember that cream always rises to the top. And so he was saying, you just do what you're supposed to do and things will come naturally to you. And that was good advice, and I've tried to remember that. We owe so much to the men and women who go and make our economy work. And I'm glad that this nation sets aside this weekend to celebrate what they do. There is no greater Christian witness than the worker at his job. When people know that the reason he is so excellent and works so hard and diligently at his job is because he's a Christian. I don't know of a better witness that one can have. And that is true whether you're a workman by the hour or in a profession. I mentioned the first work I went to out of my college training. It was Carlsbad, New Mexico. And Carlsbad, New Mexico had a man there who influenced that community so much, but also was a great witness for the church. The Church of Christ started in his home when he was a young man and moved to Carlsbad. And when I was there, more people attended the Church of Christ than any other religious group outside the Catholic Church. He was a doctor. He was the doctor of the community. And Dr. Puckett, who served for so many years, the city of Carlsbad as its public health director, was loved by everybody. But everybody knew Dr. Puckett was the leader of the Church of Christ. Nobody would say anything bad about the Church of Christ, because if they were saying something bad about the Church of Christ, they were talking about Dr. Puckett, and nobody would tolerate that. And I saw, as a young man, I saw what this one person did. I thought he was old at the time when I moved to Carlsbad. He wasn't that old. But I saw what a witness he was for the church. And I just thought, what a blessing to realize that what starts in the living room of your home suddenly becomes such a large religious group in the community. And largely it was because of the influence of Dr. Puckett as a doctor. And so whatever we do, the greatest testimony that we can give for Christ is to be good at what we do, and for people to know that the reason why we do good and why we strive to be the best that we can be is because of our commitment to Jesus Christ, because that's what we are taught. Do you see a man skillful in his work? The writer of Proverbs said, he will stand before kings. That means if you're very good at what you do, you will succeed. And like cream, you'll rise to the top. I've thought that was a lesson that we should teach all of our young people. This morning, we are privileged to have such a fine group. And in our service, we always extend the invitation of Christ for anyone who wants to confess their faith in Christ and to be a disciple. And being a disciple means that you are a good worker and you strive to be your best, and you keep in mind that you're working not for men, you're working for God. That's what discipleship really embraces. If you'd like to confess your faith and be baptized this morning, we invite you to come to the front while we stand to sing.
There's a fountain of riches for you and me. Let us gaze all days to its green. 'Tis the fount of love from the source above, and he bids us all freely drink. Will you come to the fountain free? Will you come? 'Tis for you and me. Thirsty soul, hear the welcome call. 'Tis a fountain open for all. There's a rock that's cleft, and no soul is left that may not its pure water share. 'Tis for you and me, and its stream I see. Let us hasten joyfully there. Will you come to the fountain free? Will you come? 'Tis for you and me, thirsty soul, hear the welcome call. 'Tis a fountain open for all.
Did you want to speak?